And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Okay, a great day, a great beginning for the new year. In market terms, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 330 points today. And this after an epically great year last year in the market. If you have a 401k, if you have any savings, you have any share in this growing economy right now, this is a day where you should kick back and look forward to the first weekend of the new year. And how does that comport with the fact that basically everybody gains when we have economic conditions like this? Why then are Americans so desperately eager to demonize one another? To basically, well, the president of the United States, in one of his many tweets while he's on vacation, he tweeted this morning. A lot of very good people were taken down by a small group of dirty, filthy cops, politicians, government officials, and an investigation that was illegally started and that spied, in caps, on my campaign. The witch hunt is sputtering badly, but still going on. Ukraine hoax. If this had happened to a presidential candidate or president who was a Democrat, everybody involved would long ago be in jail for treason and more. And it would be considered the crime of the century, far bigger and more sinister than Watergate. There's a piece that touched me very deeply, and it's a piece by David French, who's a friend. He's the senior editor of The Dispatch, and he's a columnist for Time magazine. He was an Iraq war vet. You probably know him from his work for a long time for National Review. David wrote a piece called Politics is a Jealous God, and it's about how political divisions have become more toxic by far and more unbridgeable than religious divisions. David, thanks for joining the show, and Happy New Year.
To you.
Well, it's my pleasure entirely to speak to you. In terms of you cite a poll that we had spoken about on the air, which I think is deeply revealing, that more people would be concerned about a child marrying someone of a different political orientation than of a different religious faith. Why is this a worrisome development for America?
Yeah, well, you know, when you point that out, what that says is that politics is achieving greater importance in people's minds than their faith, than the idea of where their soul will spend eternity is becoming less important in their minds than politics. And, you know, if you just had one poll that said people are being consumed with politics, that would be troubling enough. It's inverting the true importance of things. However, we're getting consumed with politics in a particularly toxic way. It is a politics of mutual enmity. So if you look at some of the other polling numbers that are out there, what you find is that the number of Americans who have a very unfavorable view of the opposing party has tripled, more than tripled with Democrats in their view of Republicans, almost tripled with Republicans in their view of Democrats. The way in which Republicans and Democrats view each other individually, not just as members of a party, but their individual characteristics, is terribly negative. Seeing each other as closed-minded, as unpatriotic, as lazy, as immoral, it's really stunning, and it's gotten so bad. Politics has become so important that for some small share of Americans, but it's still a significant number, will actually change their religious, ethnic, and sexual identities to match the stereotypical demographic profile of their political party, which is just stunning to me.
Okay, when you say, let's get this clear, because this was one of the reasons I wanted to have you on to talk about your piece. There is evidence now that people, if they are initially liberal, they are much more likely to talk about a either a gay or bisexual sexual orientation, or certainly a trans orientation, than they are if they are conservative. In other words, it's not that your sexual orientation is leading to a political outlook. It's that the political outlook is helping to determine a sexual orientation.
Yes. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, it does.
It sounds crazy. But let me blow your mind even a little bit more. You can have two people of the exact same ethnic composition. Like they're you know, if you did 23andMe, they would have the same empirical ethnic identity. And one who identifies as a Republican is more likely to call themselves white, and one who identifies as a Democrat is more likely to, say, call themselves Hispanic.
Or mixed race, right?
Or yes, exactly. And so what you have is here's a quote from the study. It says, significant shares of Americans engage in identity switching regarding ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, and class that is predicated by partisanship and ideology to bring their identities into alignment with their politics. That is stunning.
Where does all this come from? I mean, and you make the point in your piece that this devastating trend of politics coming before religion in the minds of people, that long precedes President Trump coming down the escalator and announcing his candidacy.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can really start to trace it rising significantly in the 1990s. So whereas it used to be that Americans were sort of in this bell curve where you had a big middle and then sort of smaller extremes, now that bell curve is flattening out. So that the middle is much smaller and the extremes are much larger. And as that has happened, you've also seen rising what's called negative polarization, where people are members of their party, not so much because they love their party's ideas, but because they hate or fear or despise the opposing side. And so as that bell curve is flattened out, there has been a rising tide of distaste. And there's also, let's just be honest about it, a shrinking amount of professed religious faith in the United States. Now, it is true that the sort of church-going population of the U.S. is a percentage is holding pretty steady. But the number of people who are non-churchgoers who identify as Christian is plunging dramatically. So you have an awful lot of people who are expressing no particular religious affiliation, and then a rising tide of political enmity. And what I think is what we're seeing is that some people are replacing religion with politics as the ultimate value and the ultimate source of meaning and purpose in their lives.
See, I think what your piece leads me to is this, David, is that I think most Americans, if you say, do you think that it would be a good thing for Americans to cross racial lines and to get to know people and to form communities together with people of different racial backgrounds, most people would say, yeah, of course. And if you ask people about that concerning people of different religious orientation, I don't think there's any question that religious hatred based upon doctrinal issues has gone way down.
Yep.
But what you're saying is right now we're sorting ourselves out not based on religion or race or ethnicity or economic background or education level. We're sorting ourselves out based on political attitudes. And
right.
The question I would have, what are the issues actually that are so divisive and so polarizing? Because you're a historian and we don't have anything that's comparable to the extension of slavery issue, which ended up dividing the country, do we?
We really don't yet. we don't yet. However, I will say this. I mean, if you look throughout history, as America becomes more religiously diverse, along with becoming more racially diverse, we're entering a period. America's always been an experiment in a Republican form of democracy, knitting together different cultures and ethnicities. It's always been an experiment in that. We're growing increasingly diverse on matters of faith. We're growing increasingly diverse on matters of politics, growing increasingly diverse on matters of ultimate meaning. And history will teach you that that's a difficult combination to kind of hang together. And so it requires a particular kind of government. It requires a particular kind of attitude amongst citizens, one of tolerance and forbearance for each other. I think it requires a government that allows citizens and communities to govern themselves, less centralized. I think all of these things are important. And unfortunately, we're going in exactly the opposite direction. We're stampeding away from grace and tolerance. I mean, is the era of our time one of crushing people and of collectively naming and shaming and destroying careers and destroying lives for infractions, sometimes a minor infraction? That's what we're becoming. We have an ever more centralized government, an ever more powerful president. All of those things are almost perfectly designed to exacerbate divisions in a very diverse society. With grace and graciousness, forbearance, tolerance, all of those things can knit us together, we're heading in exactly the wrong direction.
Okay, when you talk about heading in exactly the wrong direction, how do we change direction? Let me put a hypothetical to you, and this is one of those very dangerous questions where I have absolutely no idea how you'll respond, which is that anything could happen in this election coming up. It could be very close and one of those elections that goes either way by a few thousand votes, as it was last time. It could be a landslide for one side or the other. For this cause of national unity, what works better? To have another close election? We've had a series of fairly close elections, certainly 2012 and 2016, and then 2000 and 2004 as well. 2008 wasn't that close. But would America be better off with a decisive result this coming November of this year?
I think that when we're talking about, because we're talking about some really long-term trends, I don't think that the particular result of any given election is going to move us substantially one way or the other. I think that, you know, Obama won a pretty decisive 2008. I mean, it was the most decisive since, you know, Clinton's victories as the first Democrat to win an absolute majority of the popular vote in a generation. He won a very decisive 2008, and nothing changed in our national polarization trajectory. Then you had a close election, much closer in 2012 and super close in 2016. Again, nothing changed in this underlying trajectory. And so I think one of the things that, and in fact, placing a ton of eggs in the basket of any given presidential election is one of our problems.
Every election, this is the most important election we've ever had. There's no election that's been as important as this one. If we don't win this one, it's the end of America.
Exactly.
We've heard that every darn election, haven't we?
Exactly. And so what ends up happening is, let's say you win a decisive victory, then people overinterpret those results, believe they have giant mandates, believe that they have sort of won a once and final victory, and then they overreach and they inflame the opposition and motivate the opposition. I mean, how many times did we hear after the 2012 election, for example, that Obama and the Democratic Party was the coalition of the ascendant? In other words, because of demographics and geography and the blue wall of the Electoral College, I mean, it was just going to be Democratic presidents and progressive values from here to the horizon. And so people behaved in an arrogant fashion. They overreached. They denigrated their fellow Americans. They treated them as if their most fundamental values were just nothing but a big pile of backwards bigotry. And when you do that, you exacerbate divisions. And so, you know, there's a way in which a super close election embitters a divided population in the most obvious ways, by making people feel as if the election was illegitimate, influenced by foreign powers, influenced by the FBI, you name it. That's obvious division, but then in a strange way, in a bitterly divided country, even a relative landslide can create can exacerbate divisions because it creates a sense of doom on one side. It can create a sense of excessive arrogance and triumphalism on the other side. I think almost until we can deal with the underlying degree of enmity that we have for each other and the sense that each election is of paramount importance, I don't think we can elect our way out of this.
Okay, in response to what you're writing, and by the way, my producer, rockstar Greg Tomlin, just showed me the cover of a book, which I'd forgotten about, but it's very relevant. It was released in 2009, right after Obama's epic victory as the first person of color ever elected to our presidency. And the book's by James Carville, and it's called 40 More Years, How the Democrats Will Rule the Next Generation.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you're talking about. Oh, okay.
Exactly.
With all of this going on, Joe Biden, I think, off the cuff, suggested he would be open to finding a Republican running mate if he is the nominee. Do you take that seriously? Is that a good idea?
No, I don't take that seriously at all. I think you know how there was, I can't remember who said this, but someone said people take Trump seriously, not literally. I think I saw someone on Twitter say that was Biden speaking politically, not seriously.
Uh-huh.
That in essence, what he's trying to contrast himself with some of the harder edge partisans in the Democratic Party by presenting himself to Democrats as a person who can be a uniter, a person who can maybe start to, who's best positioned to win over people who are tired of the drama of the Trump years. And I think all of that's calculated to bolster those credentials. I don't think for one half a second he'd select an actual Republican as a running mate.
David French, do you agree with me that the most depressing possible race would be Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump?
Oh, 100%. Yes, absolutely. I think a Bernie Sanders-Trump election race is more depressing than a Hillary Clinton-Trump.
No, you're right. It's Bernie Sanders, again, Hillary Clinton is Disraeli compared to Bernie Sanders.
We're talking about a guy who didn't he honeymoon in the Soviet Union?
Yes, he did. Yeah. And by the way, he just raised this quarter $35 million.
Yes.
He's a money machine.
I don't think he'll win the nomination, but I think anyone who's writing him off and believes he isn't a very serious contender. I would give him a better chance of winning the nomination at this point than Elizabeth Warren. So I think it's a very real possibility that we could have a Trump-Sanders election. And you talk about the apocalyptic rhetoric.
Yeah. That would be horrific. Carl Rove predicted today that if Biden wins, Trump will have an uphill fight against Biden, but that Trump would win easily against any of the others. Do you share that?
I think that Trump would have an uphill fight against Biden. I think that he would have more of a fight against Buttigieg that a lot of people are believing, because Buttigieg is almost sort of crafted in a lab to appeal to the kind of suburban voters that voted Democrat in 2018. And if the Democrats can hold those suburban voters, they win the White House. I think Trump would be favored against Sanders or Warren.
Yes, I've favored, I think, prohibitively against Sanders and Warren. And I guess that's the four that we have, unless Amy Klobuchar, Michael Bloomberg. You don't think Michael Bloomberg's going to be the next president?
I don't. I think he's almost, if you're going to talk about crafted in a lab to win over suburban voters, I think Bloomberg is almost crafted in a lab to not be the candidate at the moment.
Because
he's this combination of socially very progressive and economically more conservative that just so happens to be perhaps the smallest slice of the electorate in the United States.
Speaking to David French, senior editor of The Dispatch and a columnist for Time magazine, his piece about politics as a jealous god is posted at our website, michaelmedved.com.
This is producer Rockstar Greg with the Michael Medved Show. This holiday season, we have so many great deals up at michaelmedved.com for all of our content. As you know, Michael's new book, God's Hand on America, was just released. If you buy an autographed copy at michaelmedved.com, you'll get 3 free months of membership as a Medhead. If you're already a Medhead, you can get 35% off the new book when you log into your account and use the discount code that's provided to you. A reminder, when you're a Medhead, you get the daily radio broadcast commercial-free, commentaries, Call of the Week archives, Tomlin's Take, 2 new podcasts we're doing, and also just a great way to support the show and what we're doing here. So much Medved, so little time. Thanks to all of you out there who've been such loyal listeners for so many years. From all of our crew here at the show, a very Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holidays. As we look ahead to 2020, we'll continue to try to promote timeless principles that we believe help sustain and prosper this wonderful country that we live in. Thanks for being a part of that along the way in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
The Michael Medved Show, michaelmedved.com.
And on the Michael Medved Show, I imagine that one of the reasons, among many, that the new year has begun with a bang and a roar on Wall Street has to do with the fact that the situation that was so worrisome over the weekend with it, well, it wasn't over the weekend. It was over the New Year holiday, really, the attack on the embassy in Iraq, which was so disturbing because, of course, after the expenditure of literally trillions of dollars and some 4,000 American lives to bring this new regime into power in Iraq, the idea that that new regime would not do more to protect the American embassy, the report now seems to be that, first of all, let's stipulate this is not Benghazi. The embassy was successfully protected. This was not something that hit America completely unprepared or in a negative way. And Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, had this to say about the attacks by Iran and its proxies on American interests.
If anybody challenges us, they will be met with a severe response, a strong response by U.S. forces.
What does that severe, strong response look like?
Oh, I'm not going to telegraph what we're going to do, but people know that we have vast capability to do any number of things. We will act in response to actions by Iran or its proxies, and we will act to preempt any attacks on our forces, our personnel, by Iran or its proxies.
Okay. That's fairly clear. President Trump tweeted, and one of, I think, his more praiseworthy tweets, he tweeted that his promise of the United States reacting to Iranian attempts to take over our embassy, to destroy our embassy, they'd burn parts of it, those were not simply warnings. He said, this is not a warning, it is a threat. And I'm not sure threat is the right word, but Hillary Mann Leverett, who was on MSNBC, she is the CEO of a political risk consultancy called Strategia. And she served in the U.S. National Security Council and the State Department under Presidents George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. So I guess you could say she has some deep state affiliations. In any event, she said this about the struggle at the U.S. Embassy.
You mentioned something that we talked about before the show started with the 750 U.S. troops going to the region.
Yes.
That's 750 targets, as you put it.
Yes. I mean, President Trump keeps giving the gift that keeps on giving to Iran. He's sending more troops. He's attacking war heroes, people who fought ISIS, Iraqis who fought ISIS, and claiming that somehow they're just proxy puppets of Iran. Iraq, many of them are seen as war heroes. And so he's sparking these types of backlash against the United States, against the U.S. military presence, diplomatic presence. And this just gives Iran all sorts of assets around the region. In Iraq, the U.S. embassy, the diplomats are sitting ducks. Mm. You know, many have compared it, and even President Trump has tried to not compare it to Benghazi.
Yeah.
But for some, it's also Saigon in Vietnam, where U.S. diplomats were forced to flee from the roof of the embassy by helicopter. How else are U.S. diplomats going to get out of Iraq today? This is all a victory for Iran, and 750 more troops just gives the Iranians and their friends more targets either to shoot at or possibly even to take hostage.
I think that there will be a great deal of blowback to the idea that the people who are chanting death to America, are war heroes. And I understand that she was trying to say they are war heroes in the eyes of the Shiite population in Iraq, which is a majority of the Iraqi population. The reason that Iran has so much influence in Iraq is not simply because they have assets on the ground there, that they have militias and Hezbollah and proxies for the Iranian government that are functioning on the ground in Iraq. It's because a majority of Iraqis, a majority of the population, is Shiite Muslim. And in the great struggle between the Sunni Saudis and the Shiite Iranians, they will naturally tilt in an Iranian direction. And she went on, did Hillary Mann Leverett, to say this about our position in Iraq, a position that actually was structured by precisely the administration or one of the administrations for which she worked. Listen.
And that embassy, that 100-acre-wide embassy, really is a symbolic sort of, it's symbolic of the U.S.'s enduring presence in Iraq, is it not?
And, you know, it's not seen as the presence of a friend. Mm. To have 100 acres in the heart of your capital, the beating heart of the Arab and Muslim world, Baghdad, that is, it's an occupier. It is an enduring symbol of an occupier. And even Iraqis who are angry at Iran don't like that either. And so what we see happening, and this is the real strategic problem for the United States, is that U.S. troops are going to leave Iraq. They're either going to be forced out by Iran's friends in a horribly humiliating defeat, or it's going to be a negotiated settlement. And Trump really needs to get onto the negotiating track and negotiate his way out of there. Otherwise, his 2020 election campaign is going to be like Jimmy Carter's 1980, where he's forced out of the presidency by Iran.
Where he's forced out of the presidency by Iran was what she concluded saying. Look, I do think we are going to obviously hear more about this situation. Of course, a great deal of the blame for what has happened, I think, can go back to Barack Obama, who evacuated a more substantial American presence in Iraq. And this is one of those things that actually does concern me about the future and the future for the Trump administration and this campaign is we have 27,000 U.S. troops on the ground in Korea. They've been there for a very long time. I think that almost anyone who would look at the history of the Korean Peninsula would say that the presence of those troops has been a great blessing for Korea, for the United States, and for the world. Because it is because they are there that you haven't had any further attempts by the North Koreans to invade South Korea. Now, we'll see how President Trump works out the relationship with Kim Jong-un. But the notion that the United States should simply abandon a situation like the situation in Iraq, as we did with the situation in Syria, ISIS appears to be defeated. But no one who looks at the future believes that ISIS can't come roaring back. I think that President Trump is entirely in tune with American sentiments. Americans are tired of what President Trump calls the never-ending wars, the endless wars. Of course we are. And of course the desire to bring troops home from Afghanistan, from Iraq, but making a deal with the Iranians may be even more difficult at this point than making a deal with the Taliban, which we're trying to do in Afghanistan. And I do think that the president is going to be asked when he returns and when this impeachment nonsense is behind us, and I hope it will be behind us very quickly. I think one of the questions the president is going to have to confront is, let's say we don't have a deal with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Let's say we don't have a deal with the Iranians about Iraq. Then what? Does America simply wash its hands of the matter and let the world hurtle forward? We will get to that, and also the idea of a continued culture war or a revived culture war in the United States. Are we in the midst of one? Did the culture war recede and then suddenly come back? Or is this just liberal nuttiness and alarmism? We will get to that and more coming up on The Medved Show.
Michael Medved. Show.
On the Michael Medved Show, I mentioned that there is a proclamation by the New York Times that the culture war is back. And what do they mean by that? We will get to that in just a moment. One of the things that is truly bizarre is a former acting director of the CIA was on CBS This Morning. And this very morning, first morning, January 2nd, here we are, we're in the middle of a new year. He throws this into the hopper. The idea that Iran may be playing a role in this upcoming election, and not on behalf of Trump, on behalf of some Democrat. This is Michael Morell on CBS.
Violence between the U.S. and Iranian-backed factions. Where could this take us? What's next?
Yeah. To our adversaries, does it appear that President Trump is vulnerable right now when you look at him facing impeachment and an election?
I think the Iranians are going to continue putting this pressure on us no matter what, right? No matter impeachment, no matter election. I think, interestingly, the Iranians and the North Koreans want two different things here, right? Yeah. The Iranians want a Democrat in the White House in 2021. The North Koreans want President Trump there. It's a very interesting difference.
And if I read you correctly, the Democrats might be favored by Iran because a Democrat might re-enter that nuclear agreement.
Exactly.
Is that a good reason to oppose Democrats? Sure, if you believe that Iran is one of the most evil and dangerous regimes on the planet. And by the way, so is North Korea. The idea of Iran actually, I don't believe that North Korea has ever done anything with our embassy that Iran did. And let people not forget, we had our previous comment that was made by Ms. Leverett that suggested that President Trump would go the way of Jimmy Carter. What happened with Jimmy Carter, what she was referring to was this, is that while Jimmy Carter was president and he facilitated the fall of the Shah of Iran and the installation of the mullahs and the extreme Islamic fundamentalist regime in Tehran, they stormed the U.S. embassy because the Shah was given medical treatment in the United States. That was really the basis for it. And they took our hostages in the embassy, and they held them for over a year. And it was humiliating for the country. And yes, it contributed greatly to Carter's loss. And that election, I think, is one example that where President Trump will not follow the path of Jimmy Carter, which may be one of the reasons that the Iranians are so uncomfortable with him. There are other battlefields, and there's a piece in the New York Times by Jennifer Schussler that is entitled "The Battlefield Expanded." And it says, this was a decade when the culture wars, that staple of the 1980s and 90s, came roaring back, and it began with a very predictable rerun. In 2010, religious conservatives assailed the National Portrait Gallery for displaying a video by the gay artist David Walnerowicz featuring ants crawling on a crucifix. They called it assault on religion. The gallery removed it. There were cries of censorship. Do you remember this controversy? I do very vaguely. And the idea that she talks about something that happened 10 years ago in 2010, this is something that happened this decade, it's 10 years ago, it's, oh my goodness, it's so serious. One of the stupid things about this is the reason people were protesting that in the National Portrait Gallery is it's taxpayer supported. And this is one of the reasons I think she's just dead wrong. There is no new culture war. There is, in fact, a much better understanding that there is a difference between favoring censorship and opposing sponsorship. In other words, when you're using taxpayer money to display a crucifix with ants crawling on it, why would you do that? Why would you take tax money from Americans who are the overwhelming majority identify as Christian and then take one of the symbols of Christianity and defile it with taxpayer money? You want to do that in a private gallery? Have fun. Enjoy yourself. Spend your own damn money. And the entire thing about the culture war, and yes, which I was a very eager warrior during the 1980s and 90s, was the idea that they wanted government money for it. There was this woman named Karen Finley who kept getting government grants to appear naked, and she wasn't all that. I mean, we're not talking about somebody who you want to take off her clothes. But she would take off her clothes and then smear her body with chocolate and get $5,000 from the government to do that. If she wants to do it, it's a free country. Right? She can go ahead and do that. But using taxpayer money for that purpose is entirely wrong. And by the way, that's why President Trump, I think, is perfectly right to say that one of his accomplishments as president was to get Planned Parenthood to basically surrender on Title X funding. In other words, it's not a question of closing down Planned Parenthood. Nobody's talking about that, right? Because Planned Parenthood has always gotten 2/3 of its funding from private sources. It does. Only 1/3 comes from the government at various levels. And that, it seems to me, is something that should be unnecessary. If you are talking about something as personal, as private, as contraception and abortion, right, why should it be necessary to have it funded by the government if most of it can be successfully funded by people who want to make private donations? We're talking before about the craziness. I'm still reeling from it. $35 million for Bernie Sanders? And this is after his heart attack and going for his campaign? It's a little bit weird. However, it's not government money. And that's why the Democratic ideal, and this is one of my problems with Pete Buttigieg, is Mayor Pete, I believe, has identified himself with the idea of all taxpayer-funded campaigns. That's welfare for politicians. Given the fact that there is plenty of money sloshing around out there and people can go ahead and raise the money and Elizabeth Warren is raising millions. I mean, even Andrew Yang raised $16 million this last quarter. Why should it be necessary for the government to support such people? In other words, one of the basic principles, it seems to me, of a practical, sensible, realistic conservatism is don't have the government do or spend money or run up deficits any stuff that the private sector can do better. Isn't that an acceptable principle? And the private sector is doing fine with funding campaigns. In fact, they're funding too many of them that are on the fringe. When we come back, I'm going to be welcoming to the show Myron Magnet, who for many years was with the Manhattan Institute. He's one of the leading conservative thinkers. He has a piece that is somewhat against the grain. He says that being overly concerned with hate crimes, like giving someone a 16-year term for burning a gay flag, a gay pride flag, that becomes dangerously close to enforcing standards of hate crimes. So what do we do about a rise in anti-Semitism? We'll talk about that and more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.